It's The Record on KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Bree Ripley is here monitoring social media. Tweet to us with your questions and comments. It's at KUOW. The Southern Poverty Law Center warned that a demonstration in Portland this past Saturday could be the next Charlottesville. That didn't happen, but downtown Portland echoed with flashbangs and smoke bombs thrown by police during a protest by two right-wing groups and counter-protesters. There were four arrests. These repeated protests are changing Portland. The audio you just heard captured by Erica Cruz Guevara, who's breaking news reporter from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Erica.
Hi, Ross. Thanks for having me.
So you were at this protest. I understand it was down by Waterfront Park, if people are familiar with Portland. Give us a picture of what it was like.
Yeah, so you had Patriot Prayer right-wing folks all along the waterfront. And on the opposite side of the street across from them were these, you know, left-wing counter-protesters, Antifa counter-protesters, who were essentially divided by Portland police. For the most part, they were just sort of yelling at each other from across the way while Portland police really worked to keep them separate.
Was this a homegrown protest and counter-protest, or were the protesters mostly local?
So the protesters who came with Patriot Prayer were from actually Washington State. A lot of them had bussed in from Vancouver, Washington. The leader of Patriot Prayer, Joey Gibson, is based in Vancouver, Washington, and really his strategy has been to, you know, come into liberal enclaves like Portland to sort of have these what he calls free speech rallies, and they're always met by counter-protesters from Portland, Antifa folks from Portland.
This guy, Joey Gibson, one of the organizers of the right-wing group, encouraged his supporters who were legally able to bring their guns to this protest. Were there a lot of guns visible at the protest?
So Portland police actually came out before the protest happened and said that it would not allow guns at this protest. Oregon does not automatically recognize concealed handgun licenses issued in other states, including Washington, where Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson and many of his supporters live. And Gibson even told OPB in an interview before the protest that he can't even legally carry in Portland because of that reason.
Now, the ACLU is saying that the police at this demonstration on Saturday in Portland were more aggressive with the counter-protesters, Antifa, than with the right-wing groups, the Proud Boys, the Patriot Prayer. What did you see?
Yeah, police deployed what they call riot control agents and these sort of less lethal impact weapons. They use pepper spray, rubber balls, stinger rounds, aerial distraction devices, mostly at a left-wing counter-protesters. One of the rounds reportedly hit a counter-protester in the head and embedded in his helmet and injured him. And this is sort of something that you know, activists have said that over and over again that they are seeing at these protests, that police see left-wing folks as sort of more dangerous than right-wing protesters. A local reporter actually with the Willamette Week sorted out some draft reports from a city review of how Portland police handled dueling protests last summer. And the reports sort of reveal how Portland police talked about these dueling groups. One lieutenant felt that right-wing protesters were, quote, much more mainstream than left-wing protesters, and that they were sort of diverse in their viewpoints and tactics, is what he said. The report also found that police had much more robust communication with Patriot Prayer organizers, that they were frequently exchanging text messages, and officers viewed protesters on the left as, you know, they referred to them as, quote, volatile.
Erica Cruz Guevara, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Erica, breaking news reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting. She was covering that big demonstration which took place in Portland on Saturday. There were four arrests, but thankfully it didn't turn into the violence that some feared that it would. It's The Record on KUOW. Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Coming up, meet three Democratic candidates for Congress in the 8th District. Tomorrow's primary election will determine which one goes to face presumptive Republican nominee Dino Rossi this November. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Time is running out to get your primary ballot in the mail. They have to be postmarked or dropped into a ballot drop box by 8 p.m. tomorrow. One of the most closely watched races is over the U.S. House seat in District 8. It's to replace Republican Congressman Dave Reichert. Well, last week, Bill Radke sat down with the three leading Democratic candidates, Kim Schreier, Jason Rittereiser, and Shannon Hader. They each had a chance to explain where they stand on the issues and why you should vote for them. We also reached out to the Republican Party nominee Dino Rossi, but his campaign did not return our emails. We start with Jason Rittereiser. Bill Radke began the conversation by asking Rittereiser about his history in District 8.
It's a district that I care deeply about. I was born and raised in the district, grew up over in Ellensburg, grew up in a law enforcement family. My dad became a police chief in our town. My mom served on the Ellensburg City Council, and I worked on a hay farm out in the Kittitas Valley to pay for college at the University of Washington, just down the road here. I got a degree in economics, and then I went to work for Congressman Rick Larson in the 2nd District, then to law school, and I came back to serve as a criminal prosecutor for King County. And I've been in private practice as a labor and employment lawyer fighting for workers' rights for the past 5 years.
A couple of things you brought up. It is a unique place, a district that straddles the Cascades. Issaquah and Ellensburg and so many other places. Given that diversity, how do you approach environment and land issues?
Yeah. You know, it's a microcosm of the country. We have farming and agriculture. We have high tech, big business. We have manufacturing and labor and literally everything in between. But there is not a district in the country that is better situated to advocate for the environment because 50% of the district are public lands. We have renewable energy technology that's leading the country, and we also have conservation efforts that are second to none. And so bridging, I think, both sides of the district to represent and be a strong advocate for the environment is going to be essential in the United States Congress.
It's also a politically diverse district, and one issue has been health care and how progressive a health care solution Democrats ought to advocate. What kind of health care do you want to see put through Congress?
You know, Bill, I think that health care ought to be a human right in the United States of America, that we ought to push for a universal health care system that covers every single man, woman, and child in this country. I believe the solution to our solving our health care crisis is to address both access and costs. And I think we best do that through a Medicare for All system. I would proudly sponsor H.R. 676, which I believe is the gold standard for universal health coverage and for a Medicare for All system. But it's important to understand the dynamics of this district because in Eastern Washington, 34% of the patient population is on Medicaid, and 16% is on Medicare, and 15% are uninsured, which means 65% of this district in Kittitas and Chelan counties combined are either on government health care or uninsured. And we need, I think, progressive leaders who are going to stand on the front lines and take bold stances to solve that challenge.
So Medicare for All, does that mean one single-payer government program giving every American comprehensive coverage, no copays, no deductibles, no competing private insurers, or is it something less than that?
It's a comprehensive plan that outlines coverage for every single man, woman, and child in this country. I think it's important that we put everyone in the same risk pool. It'll drive down costs. It'll lower premiums. It'll ultimately provide a solution both to access and to costs that we see right now. There's 126 co-sponsors of H.R. 676 already. We just saw the formulation of the Medicare for All caucus, and that's something that I would proudly join.
How would we pay for that?
Well, look, right now we spend about $3 trillion on healthcare in America per year. Medicare for All would cost about $1.5 trillion. We're going to have to, I think, readjust how we pay for healthcare in this country. But ultimately, it's going to save us about half the cost that we're currently spending on healthcare.
What do you think of some Democrats calling to abolish the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, ICE?
You know, I much prefer Immigration and Naturalization Services like we had before 9/11. But I think drawing the blame on the agency rather than focusing on where the directives are coming from is a bit misplaced. I think that we have to send new people to Congress who are going to stand up to the Trump administration, especially when it comes to immigration. And I'm not waiting until I get to Congress to do it. We launched a nationwide pro bono legal effort to represent federal employees who are conscientious objectors to the illegal Trump immigration policies. And I think we need that type of thinking when it comes to combating this administration.
Immigrants are important to Eastern Washington farming economies, and yet some Eastern Republicans in your district approve of Trump's immigration policies. How do you navigate that East-West divide, if you see it that way?
No, look, I think that immigration is a bipartisan issue in this district. I think that immigration is something that unites the Cascade Mountains because exactly what you said, we have farmers and agriculture community that rely on the H-2A visa program for temporary farm workers. We have folks that rely on the H-2B visa program for temporary workers. And I think what's indicative of this issue is that the tree fruit growers in Wenatchee recently published an op-ed calling for a clean DACA bill. And I think that that shows how this district believes immigration ought to be handled, and that's with dignity and respect and keeping our promises.
Clean DACA bill, does that mean citizenship for? This is about protecting childhood arrivals, so-called dreamers. You would do what for those DACA recipients? And how would you get that done where it's been so hard to pass?
Well, the only reason it's been hard to pass is because they won't allow a vote in the United States Congress. There's something like 80% approval for a clean DACA bill, and Paul Ryan is holding up a vote on that bill. That's why it's so important that Democrats take back control of Congress. We could pass these comprehensive bipartisan bills if we had the opportunity to do it.
You're advocating citizenship for DACA arrivals?
Yeah, I think part of the first step is legal status and citizenship for those who are here. I also believe that there needs to be a path to citizenship for our undocumented immigrants who are here in the community and have been a contributing member of our society.
Again, we're talking with Jason Ritterizer, a candidate for Congress as a Democrat in the 8th District to replace Dave Reichert. Should President Trump get credit for the growing economy, 4.1% growth in the last quarter?
I think at the heart of the growth in the economy right now is a bit of a misconception that it's helping working class people. I think that the economy is growing for really, really big corporations and really, really rich people. We just saw that Apple became the first company to be worth $1 trillion. And certainly they're getting the benefits of a Trump administration economic agenda. Who's not getting the benefits are the people I grew up with. People in the 8th Congressional District who are paying more for groceries, paying more for gas. They've been paying more for a long time when it comes to health care and it comes to education and child care. And wages have been stagnant. They haven't had a pay raise in 2 decades. We just saw that on the back of the tax bill, wages have decreased. And I think that this is not an economy that is working for the vast majority of Americans.
Some Washington state companies don't like the president's trade tariffs, and they're calling for free trade. Others are calling for fair trade, not so free. What kind of trade policies do you support?
You know, I used to cut the hay that depends on low-cost access to foreign markets in Kittitas County. And I think we can approach trade from a perspective that protects American jobs, that reflects our values, meaning protecting labor standards, protecting environmental standards, ensuring that these trade agreements include human rights standards, and that we roll those protections directly into the trade agreements.
You ran a TV ad accusing President Trump of treason. Are you calling for a criminal charge of treason?
Look, the president of the United States stood on a stage on foreign soil with Vladimir Putin after meeting with him for 2 hours in a closed-door room in which he won't even tell his advisors what they discussed, and then denounced American law enforcement and sided with Vladimir Putin when it came to their cyber war that's been declared on the United States of America, hacking our democracy. That, to me, is treason. And the idea that we don't have a Congress that's willing to step up and take on a Trump administration that's conducting itself like that across this world is absurd to me. The 116th Congress is going to be defined on two things. One is putting a check on the Trump administration, and two, on getting things done for the American people. And that's why we have to take back control of the House as Democrats.
Well, treason has a criminal definition, and the state Republican Party called your ad radical, desperate rhetoric and contrasted it with Dino Rossi's common sense leadership and bipartisan approach. Did using the word treason go too far, too heated?
Look, I've spent a career as a criminal prosecutor looking at fact patterns, analyzing the law, and applying what I think is appropriate discourse and results when it comes to conduct. I think that the idea that this wasn't treasonous behavior is a little silly. And the fact that Republicans aren't willing to step up and put country over party is a little scary.
Dino Rossi has a head start with a cash advantage and no real primary opposition. How do you beat him in the general?
You know, Rossi is going to be funded by the Koch brothers, by Donald Trump. We just got word he's taking money directly from the president, by Mike Pence's PAC, by Paul Ryan's PAC. He's going to be incredibly well-funded, and he'll be a very formidable opponent. But it is so important that we win this time around that I think we're seeing a rise of activism in this district that we haven't seen before. And I think I'm uniquely situated to beat Dino Rossi and compete for votes in every single corner of this district.
That's Jason Ritterizer. He's a Democrat running for Congress to replace retiring Representative Dave Reichert in Washington's 8th District. He was speaking to Bill Radke. Stay tuned to hear from two more Democratic candidates for Congress in the 8th District. The deadline to get your ballots in is 8 o'clock tomorrow evening. This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Let's move on to a second Democratic candidate running for Congress in the 8th District to try to replace retiring Representative Dave Reichert. We're going to hear from Dr. Shannon Hader. Bill Radke began the conversation by asking about her background.
I am an Auburn girl. I am fifth generation in the Auburn-Kent Tukwila Valley. Grew up on my great-grandfather's old farm property. Dad is a Navy vet and a Boeing guy. My mom taught dance and art at community centers. I graduated from Auburn High, went off to Stanford, became the first person in my family to get a four-year degree. Went on to become a medical doctor, so I'm a pediatrician, an internist, an infectious disease doc, and I do a lot of public health. And when I was done with my training, I chose a life of service. I joined the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service, was assigned to CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as a virus hunter or an epidemic intelligence service officer. Been stationed and deployed all over the country, all over the world, fighting disease, saving lives. Most recently, I was back at CDC running our Division of Global HIV and TB that I managed with, accountability, transparency, driving outcomes up and quality up and unit costs down. And when I left, my team and I had contributed to more than 2.2 million babies being born HIV-free across this globe who otherwise would have been infected.
You have a lot of healthcare experience. Let's talk about healthcare. What do you want to accomplish in healthcare?
So I've been a clinician delivering bedside care person to person. I have helped set up clinics and improve their quality. I've helped hospitals. I've been on the board of a safety net hospital, so I've seen what those margins are during healthcare reform. And I spent a year as a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow up on Capitol Hill. And all the way around, I am committed to essentially universal healthcare. I truly believe we should have 100% affordable, high-quality healthcare for all, period.
There's a proposal for a single-payer government program. There's a Medicare for All bill in Congress. Do you support that?
So for me, my priorities are, number one, lower drug costs. We can do that by using the bargaining power of Medicare. Number two, start letting people opt in or buy into Medicare at younger and younger ages, 55, 50, and broader markets, so our costs for young, healthy people go down. Third, I think we need to accelerate some of our cost reforms and modernize our fraud prevention so we're putting more money back into the system. And then fourth, and this gets to your single-payer question, I truly believe from the federal level, we need to provide the flexibility and the wherewithal for states that are ready and have constituency support to get out ahead and implement single-payer to go ahead and do so.
So for now, you don't support the Medicare for All proposal that's in Congress?
I support Congresswoman Jayapal's state-based universal health care bill, which is sort of what I just described.
People are watching the 8th District as sort of a swing district. You're hoping to swing it from Republican to Democrat and wondering, how progressive Democrats in a district like that can afford to be. Some of the proposals from, I guess you could call it the progressive wing of the party, would be to abolish ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I don't necessarily believe that abolishing ICE will achieve what we need to do. I don't believe that just changing form will necessarily change function. I think the challenge right now is we have the wrong culture going on at ICE, the wrong oversight and management and directives from the executive. So to me, I would rather get behind changing that function and providing congressional oversight to hold performance accountable, so that a lot of our folks who are experts and would like to be functioning differently can do the right thing.
What's an outcome you think you can change when it comes to this gridlock on immigration? Just one issue has been the question of citizenship for childhood arrivals, the DACA recipients, the Dreamers. Where do you stand? What would you do differently?
Yeah, I actually think we have an opportunity from this district to be an important voice in the national conversation. I tell you, nearly everyone I've talked to is pro a clean and clear DACA bill. We've got our
DACA bill, meaning the childhood arrivals.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've got strong Republican orchardists who say, you know what, I don't want my communities, the communities of some of my workers, where my workers, yeah, they have citizenship or they have permanent residency, but not necessarily everyone in their family does. I don't want those communities of the people I care about who've been part of my company and community for a long time destabilized.
Let's talk a little about trade. Some companies in Washington don't like the president's trade tariffs, and they're calling for free trade. Some Democrats say free trade isn't good enough. They want fair trade. What kind of trade policies do you support?
Yeah, well, I definitely support fair trade policies, because I think free trade sometimes, it might be free to the companies, but it's not free to the citizens all the time. We're supplementing that in different ways. Nobody wants a winner-take-all in their sector that's going to, you know, really negatively impact or shut out another part of the district. We can negotiate agreements that have good standards for workers, for environment, for health, and that have better enforcement, and enforcement that is more like a scalpel than an axe.
My guest is Shannon Hader. She wants to replace Congressmember Dave Reichert in the 8th District. She's a Democrat. You sent out a mailer portraying your rival Kim Schreier as opposed to mandatory vaccinations. Do you really think a pediatrician doesn't believe in vaccines?
There's a very different thing between being pro-vaccine and being pro-vaccine policy change.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, you know, and on this topic, there are a few things that all pediatricians know. All pediatricians know that being pro-vaccine is not the same thing as being pro-vaccine policy change. All pediatricians know that the topic, the policy topic under discussion is whether or not to adopt the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation that government require vaccinations and eliminate all non-medical exemptions. Every Washington pediatrician knows that Washington state policy is not aligned with that AAP recommendation.
We allow religious exemptions?
And personal choice, just your whim. So in the forum where we were asked, you know, do you support the government requiring childhood vaccinations? When Dr. Schreier held up a red paddle, I was shocked, you know, as being against that. I was pretty surprised. When afterwards, she said, oh, it was just a mistake, I just didn't understand the question, I had a little bit of a difficulty understanding that because of those things that all pediatricians know. But, you know, people make mistakes. That's okay. However, for the next 4 months after that, every time she had the opportunity to clarify, whether it was Facebook questions or on her website that changed multiple times, all of her statements said that I support policy in line with Washington state policy, which to me is just holding up a red paddle over and over and over again.
We've talked about how the 8th District is a unique district. straddling the Cascade Mountains, Issaquah, Ellensburg, and many other places. Given that diversity, how do you approach environment and land issues?
My whole approach to policy is that I don't believe in one-size-fits-all policy. I believe we can do precision policy, just like I've done precision public health. And I have spent a lot of time talking to different mayors and different communities around here to see what their issues are specifically and how we meld those together. On environment, there are a lot of things we agree on across the entire district. Number one, the need to protect our public lands. Nobody in this district wants our public lands sold off to the highest bidder or contaminated for their children. Boom. Two, I think, you know, we have a real momentum for wanting to invest in mitigation of the climate effects we are already experiencing. And then I think third, this, you know, idea that we have the resources, particularly east of the mountains, to build the basis of an innovation green economy. But we haven't yet invested in the infrastructure, like the modernized grid, the expanded grid that will allow us to do that. Former Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell has endorsed me in this race, and I'm pretty sure that means I've got a really good resource for dialing up and asking advice and getting things done.
If Democrats were to take the House, would you support impeachment charges against President Trump based on what you know so far?
You know, based on what I know so far, I want to see the end of the Mueller investigation. So, you know, I will see where we're at in January 2019. And we'll look at where we're at with the actual findings and see if the Mueller investigation is done and make a decision based on that evidence.
Dino Rossi, the Republican, has a head start in this election with a cash advantage and no real primary opposition. How would you beat him in the general?
Yeah, you know, I think Dino is going to be a formidable opponent. Folks have heard me say that I think he is a pretty smooth talker as well. So I'm all about making this campaign about what I call proof points over talking points. You know, saying, Dino, you show me yours, I'll show you mine. You show me where you have used federal people, policy, and dollars to change people's life for the better. Because he hasn't. But I have.
That's Shannon Hader, a Democrat running for Congress to replace Representative Dave Reichert in Washington's 8th District. She was speaking with Bill Radke. We're hearing from all three candidates. Hear from the third coming up in a moment. I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Record. We're hearing from the top Democrats running in Washington's 8th District. Why? Well, the primary election is tomorrow. One of these three candidates will move forward to run in the final election in November. It's time for the third candidate, Dr. Kim Schreier. Bill Radke began that conversation by asking about her background.
Well, I had a little bit of an unconventional path to running for Congress. I'm a pediatrician. I've been working and living in the 8th District for the past 17 years, taking care of thousands of children. And running for office was never in my life plan. But the 2016 election was a huge wake-up call. And I really consider this administration to be a direct threat to children and families everywhere. I did what I could do as a citizen. I rallied, I marched, I protested. And when that first Trump care bill came out, I went to bat for my patients and met with Reichert's office, explained all the ways that it would be terrible for my patients and people all over this district to lose the ACA. And days later—
Affordable Care Act.
The Affordable Care Act, yes. And days later, he voted for that first Trump care bill in committee. And I was ticked off and I thought, you know, the pediatrician with type 1 diabetes could totally run against the sheriff and beat him, and I'm in.
And he's out.
He's out. Yeah. Now I'm running against Dino Rossi.
Right. And there are so many different issues at play. One of them is the question of health care. You have said, I believe, that you want affordable, high-quality health care for all. Does that mean one single-payer government program giving everybody comprehensive coverage, no copays, no deductibles, no competing private insurers, or does it mean something else?
So that first part sounds fantastic. I love the idea of having the same system for everybody and not having to deal with insurance companies. And so ultimately, Medicare for All is where I would like to go. And
Medicare
frankly,
for All.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are signs of me from a year and a half ago holding up a sign that says improved ACA equals Medicare for All. So yes, I think that's the way we should go. I think most doctors believe the same. The problem is that right now we have the ACA under attack and we are seeing prices skyrocket. And I have moms who come into my clinic crying because their rates, I mean, listen to these rates, $1,700 a month for their family and then a $10,000 deductible. So I don't think we have the luxury of waiting until we can roll out a Medicare for all to do something. And that's why I've proposed this interim solution, which is having Medicare as a buy-in public option. And that way, anybody can buy into Medicare. It provides a cost-effective option. We'll have it on a sliding scale with subsidies available. And that'll also put pressure on private insurance companies to bring their costs down and efficiencies up.
What do you think of some Democrats calling to abolish the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, ICE?
Well, I think it is a little bit too simplifying. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we have a broken immigration system and we need comprehensive immigration reform. And the reason that we are seeing this terrorizing of families and sort of the misapplications of laws is just that we have a pretty inhumane guy at the top of the ladder. And so he is using a broken immigration system to enforce our laws in the most draconian ways, separating children from their parents, terrorizing people. You know, what we should be doing at a congressional level is passing a comprehensive immigration reform and prioritizing the deportation of criminals.
Dr. Kim Schreier is a Democrat running to replace Dave Reichert in Congress in the 8th District of Washington State. Some Washington State companies don't like President Trump's trade tariffs, and they're calling for free trade. I think you're calling for fair trade. What's the difference?
Well, fair trade makes sure that you have a level playing field. It means that when we enter into trade agreements, and I very much support entering into trade agreements. I mean, think about it. If you are in a trade agreement with another country, you are far less likely to escalate conflict, far less likely to get into war. And so, you know, if we can have good relationships with other countries and trade with them, what we have to make sure is that we don't impose regulations and commitments on our side that aren't enforced on the other. So a perfect example would be, you know, we have environmental standards in this country that our companies need to meet, and we need to make sure that those same environmental restrictions and requirements are met on both sides of a trade deal. So I would say the same thing about labor standards. I would say that about salaries. We need to have trade deals and not a tariff war.
One of your rival Democrats, Shannon Hader, is trying to portray you as opposed to mandatory vaccinations. What is your position?
Isn't that the craziest thing? My position is that I believe we should have mandatory vaccinations because we have had outbreaks of some really serious illnesses. And I've seen other states impose mandatory vaccinations after the fact. I think we are better served to mandate them before we have a measles outbreak, for example.
It sounds like you were questioning the language in a debate about whether this ought to be completely mandatory.
Well, you know, what happened was I misheard the question. I raised the wrong card, and I have been paying for it on a daily basis ever since.
As we've said, the 8th District is a unique place across the Cascades, Issaquah, Ellensburg, et cetera. Given that diversity, how do you approach environment and land issues?
You know, the diversity is not as diverse as you would think in that respect. I mean, we are a hunting and fishing district. We all appreciate our public lands. And so one of the things that really unites all of us is the encroachment on our public spaces. And we want to keep public lands public. They are not places where we should be extracting more of our Earth's riches. These are for us to play in. And don't forget that the recreational economy is a huge segment of our economy, especially in the eastern part of the district. And by preserving our public lands and preserving our environment, our recreational economy does better.
What about the fact that immigrants are important to farming economies east of the Cascades? Do you see an east-west divide there in your district?
I mean, what I hear is that orchardists are really concerned. I had a meet and greet in Wenatchee, and it was sort of like all comers. People asked about immigration, and they asked about tariffs. And I just answered the way that I answered you here. And it turned out five of the people there were orchardists. And they came up and they said, you know what, I think you can get the orchardist vote because you have a really matter-of-fact, sound position on this. And so I do hear about immigration, and orchardists in particular are concerned.
Should President Trump get credit for a growing economy? 4.1% in the second quarter.
No. I don't give him credit. I mean, what happens is that I think he measures the economy by how the stock market is performing. And that is not how we should be measuring our economy. We should be measuring it based on who has food security and housing security and how people are doing.
But what about 4.1% growth in the economy? Not the stock market, but in the economy. That's quite a big number. In the GDP.
I think that he is inflating the real results. And what I have heard in other estimates is that we anticipate that this will go down over the next years.
If Democrats were to take the House, based on what you know so far, are you prepared to say whether you would support impeachment charges against the president, or is that too soon to say?
Well, here's what I'm prepared to say. I have real concerns about this president. I mean, the whole reason I'm running is that I have concerns about the well-being of children and families across this district under this president. I have concerns about profiting off the presidency and the emoluments clause and collusion, all of that. But what I really want is I want to know what really happened. So my first step would be to protect the Mueller investigation.
How would you do that?
I think it's incumbent upon Congress to actually pass a law that says, protect Mueller. You can't fire him. Same thing with Rosenstein.
Dino Rossi, the Republican, has quite a head start with a cash advantage and no real primary opposition. How do you beat Dino Rossi in the general?
Well, he's going to be tough. But the fact of the matter is, yeah, he's a good fundraiser, but so am I. I've raised $1.7 million with a contested primary. And I have over 6,500 donors who are just right there ready to donate for the general election as well. There's tremendous enthusiasm. And so we will have the funding that we need, and we're also going to have feet on the ground. I mean, what I have built in order to take on Dino Rossi is really, it's like an army. It is an army of hundreds of volunteers. It's an army of organizers in every corner of this district. We have knocked over 60,000 doors. So we are touching voters who have said they've never been approached by a Democrat before. I'm up on TV. I'm raising money. We have tons of volunteers. And I have the largest endorsements in this race. And I have Emily's List, which is a political powerhouse, and Planned Parenthood and their volunteers. So they helped make Dino a three-time loser, and I trust that my whole army will make him a four-time loser.
That's Kim Schreier, a Democrat running for Congress, to replace retiring Representative Dave Reichert in Washington's 8th District. You also heard Democratic candidates Jason Ritterizer and Shannon Hader speaking to Bill Radke. If you missed any of them, they're going to be up on our website by mid-afternoon, a good chance for you to compare and contrast the candidates. Now, you might be wondering why you didn't hear from the most prominent Republican candidate in the 8th, Dino Rossi. We did reach out to invite Dino Rossi in for an interview. His campaign did not return our emails. Up ahead, one of the two unavoidable aspects of life. Spoiler alert, it's not taxes. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is The Record. There's always been a fascination with death, but there's a growing body of contemporary literature and writing about death. Barbara Ehrenreich was here in May talking about her book Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. She argues that baby boomers are unrealistically clinging to life. Physician and writer Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End explored how doctors view death as a failure and how that ill serves people at the end. Joining them on the bookshelf, Portland, Oregon-based writer Sally Tisdale, along with her books Talk Dirty to Me and Stepping Westward. Sally is also a registered nurse. She works for 3 days a week at a palliative care center where they focus on bringing relief from the symptoms of improving quality of life, often at the end of life. And she also conducts death and dying study groups. Her new book is called Advice for Future Corpses and Those Who Love Them. Sally Tisdale, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, you may have some reactions to what we're hearing. You can tweet at us, at KUOW. We'd love to get your responses to what we're talking about. Now, you concede on the first page of your book, you've never died, so your book is a fool's advice, yet you wrote it anyway.
Yeah, I did. And in a way, I think we all have died in that we're not who we were yesterday. We're not who we were 10 years ago or 30 years ago. We know what it's like to change dramatically. We've watched our bodies change. We watch our minds and our opinions change. So in a way, we're moving toward a time when that happens in a fairly dramatic way. But is it qualitatively different than the way we just grow and develop? I don't know. So I'm applying some of what I've learned from just being a human being and watching a lot of other people go through this.
There's so much talk about having a good death.
Right.
What does that mean to you?
So we have a stereotype about the good death. And when I teach classes or study groups in this, the good death is often posited as I'm in my own bed, in my own home. I'm surrounded by people who love me. I'm peaceful. Some people want to be awake, others don't. But there's this, there's an idealization of that moment. And I have a chapter in the book where I compare and contrast different kinds of what I think of as good deaths that are very different. To me, it's better to talk about an appropriate death for a person because the death will reflect the life. And I think the most important thing we can bring to our deathbed is the attitude of acceptance and curiosity, because in the end, no matter how you plan, no matter what you hope for, it will not be in your control. This is one of the things that we have no control over at all in the end. And so we have to be able to approach it with some open-handedness. What happens will happen. Now, there's a lot you can do to improve the outcomes and to make it more what you hope. But there has to be a little bit of wonder and curiosity about what really will happen.
When you say you'd rather use the term appropriate death, is there an appropriate death for all of us, or is it individualized?
I think it is to a large extent an outcome of your life. However, the problems we see are people who have made no effort to make their wishes known. And so the outcome of their life ends up being appropriate to somebody else. Mm-hmm. It ends up coming from someone else's point of view. If you are ill or aging and you've made no comment about what you want, it will be a doctor or a nurse or a family member who you may never have spoken with about it who makes that decision. That's not an appropriate death. I don't care what it looks like. An appropriate death is a death that comes out of your own development.
You were born in 1957. I was born in 1952, so we're at a certain age. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we think about death differently, either from people from our generation or kind of more to the point, young versus old. I mean, right. When I was young, I sure didn't think about it at all. I think about it a whole lot more now.
Well, that's natural. We are from the generation that the product of a medicalization of childbirth. So from the beginning of our lives, our generation came out of a very sort of a disease-oriented view of normal development and a doctor-driven world. And the new generation, the generation that is beginning to really reach its maturity now, has been exposed to a different way of looking at health. So, you know, we rediscovered natural childbirth and we rediscovered eating your vegetables. And now we're kind of rediscovering that death is normal and death is a part of life. The way death has been eliminated from public view, and the fact that many Americans never see a dead body or never with a dying person, that's actually very unusual. It's rare in human history, and I think it's rare in human experience today. If you look at the world as a whole, most people in the world are not as cut off from it as we are. So I'm really pleased to see the beginning of what is called a death awareness movement. But I also don't think it's new. I think it's a rediscovery of normal human behavior.
I'm talking to Sally Tisdale. Her new book is called Advice for Future Corpses, A Practical Perspective on Death and Dying. Atul Gawande and others have written a lot about how the medical profession is kind of ideally changing its views towards death, not viewing it as simply a failure. You're also someone in the medical profession. Does the medical profession sufficiently look at quality of life at the end of life? All too often we hear it's preserving life at all costs.
Well, and, you know, Atul Gawande is someone else who is discovering something that we used to know. The medical profession is returning in some ways to its roots, but with the new tools of new medications and new ways of judging discomfort and symptom management. So I have a skewed view in that I work in a palliative care system, which means it's to manage symptoms and improve comfort and quality of life. And I work with doctors and nurses who are dedicated to that and very experienced. So in my experience, it is much more how we are approaching death. And I sometimes work in the hospital managing our patients who have been hospitalized, and the biggest problem comes from the lack of conversations people have had with their family, the lack of planning, and a disconnect in the family about what a person really wants. So we spend a lot of time just trying to get everybody on the same page. If we have these conversations in advance, and I have to say, you can't have that conversation with others until you have it with yourself. Hmm. If we can do that in advance, a lot of the worst problems can be prevented.
Well, and we don't think about it. We push it away. You've written, if you want to be more comfortable with death, spend time near it.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
And, you know, and you, in this culture, in a modern America, you have to make the effort. It's not going to show up in your living room. It used to be there. It used to be, even not, you know, 100 years ago, not very long, it was present in people's lives. Now we have to go looking for it. There are a lot of different ways to come into it. There are all kinds of volunteer opportunities to spend time with the aging and the dying. People do have a somewhat romantic idea. I'll be a volunteer at the hospice and I'll be at the bedside when someone has their, you know, spiritual moment. In fact, go to the nearest nursing home where there's an elderly person who has no family and is all alone, and they're really confronting age and infirmity, and do what you can with them. That not only allows you to be closer to people who are dying, but it's going to give you a little explanation of what happens for you as you get older. You know, I agree that, you know, as Barbara Ehrenreich says, our generation has been very fearful about aging. And it seems so silly to me. What else do we think is going to happen? What do we really have this idea that somehow we're going to have an impact on that, a qualitative impact on aging and death? Much more effective to me is to keep your eyes open, to look at it with curiosity and wonder.
Another thing that Barbara Ehrenreich wrote in her book, Natural Causes, quote, "The truly sinister possibility is that for many of us, all the little measures we take to remain fit, all the deprivations and exertions, will only lead to a longer chance to live with crippling and humiliating disabilities," end quote.
Yeah.
True?
And well, as I say, namaste, you're dead. It doesn't really, in the end, yes, you can actually, I mean, I work with people who, younger than me, are not able to walk because they've taken such poor care of their health. Of course, there's a way where we need to take care of ourselves and do basic wellness. But I also see people who seem to have this kind of grimacing, painful approach to extreme levels of fitness and diet, as though they can hold back change. There's a middle way there. There's a moderate approach where we're taking care of ourselves and gracefully accepting the change that comes. Does it ever occur to you to lie about how old you are? It just seems so odd to me.
Like, not anymore.
Have I done something to be ashamed of? Of course not. It's just, it comes to all of us.
Yeah.
And one of the things I want people to take away from this book is to really remember that death is natural. Death is universal. So our fear about it is kind of odd in a way. Everything goes there. Everything comes to this.
You know, you mentioned the importance of kind of connecting with death. You talked about maybe going to a nursing home. Some people might not want to do that. I've also heard the suggestion that everyone think about death for 15 minutes a day.
Well, and that's actually it's a practice in all major religions. It's done in every personal religious practice. There is the suggestion that you spend a little bit of time every day imagining that moment. It's more explicit in some religions than others, but I think that is really excellent practice. So one of the things I ask people to do in my classes is imagine your ideal death, spend a little time with that, really fantasize, and then imagine that the meteor is on its way and it's going to hit in 2 minutes. This is it, you and me right here in this room. We're the last thing. This is what we get. How does that feel? How does the possibility that it won't be like you think it will be at all, how does that land? Mm-hmm. Because it could be that.
You write in your introduction to Advice for Future Corpses, the strange, undeniable fact that the presence of death can be joyful.
Yes, absolutely. I think everybody really knows this in their heart. we love each other. We have intimate relationships, but there's also a kind of self-defense in most of our relationships. We protect a little part of our heart from each other. But when someone you love dies, there's nothing left to protect. And I have found that my love for the people I've lost is deeper and more pure than anything. We cherish each other so much when we come to the end of our life. A lot of the decoration and the extra veneer of our way of being together falls away. There's something very plain and pure about it.
You know, when I think about that in my own regard, I think one thought is, oh, Lord, take me fast. If I could fall asleep and never
come back. That's a very common.
But then part of me thinks, well, what about, that would be a horrible thing to leave people so quickly, to not have any time with them.
See, to me, I don't want to die in my sleep because I think it's going to be a really interesting experience. I think it's going to be an adventure, like going for a hike to a place you've never been. You don't know what's around that corner. I really don't want to miss that.
Wow. Going for a hike to some place you've never been. Sally Tisdale. That's some advice for future corpses and those who love them. That's the name of her new book. It's A Practical Perspective on Death and Dying. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for tuning into The Record. Coming up tomorrow, national security agencies are issuing grave warnings about attempted Russian infiltration in the fall elections. What's Washington State doing to guarantee the integrity of our elections? We'll ask Washington Secretary of State Kim Wyman. The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley, Amanda Wild, is in control. I'm Ross Reynolds. Bill Radke's back tomorrow.